folks, we'll go ahead and get started. This series, this is the third in a series of five, and you're welcome to come back another day if you'd like. If not, it'll stand alone. I think it makes sense to you. And the topic is leadership as treasure. And so the week is really exploring what is this treasure. We've spent a little time looking at, how many ways do people think about and define leadership? And put leadership in the, Google, you'll get millions of hits. If you put it in your interlibrary loan, you'll get thousands of books. If you write in definitions, you'll get hundreds of definitions. So the one thing I can assure you is that we probably need to work together on what your definition is going to be based on your context, because there are many, many ways to approach it. We've talked about authority and power and what those mean. We're going to come back to authority today and spend a little bit more time on that. We talked about the traits that leaders have. That is that research will show that people that other people might call leaders have this combination of intelligence, self-confidence, determination, integrity, and sociability, or what some will call emotional intelligence or affinity in being with people. And then we looked at transformational leadership, and again, ways of working that describe those leaders who inspire us and cause us to do something in our organizations that are that may be more than we ever thought we could do. And those qualities are idealized influence, that is, that they live an example that people want to follow, that they are inspirational and really set goals that are beyond what people think they could do, but they are inspired to go a little bit further. That they intellectually stimulate the people that are their colleagues in the organization, giving them challenges to solve problems, to be creative, to innovate, and that's a very common characteristic. And then finally, individual consideration, that those leaders that are transformational, the people in the organization feel like the leader has listened to them personally and has responded in a way that is in response to their individual needs. So that set of characteristics describe what John McGregor Burns calls a transformational leader. Yesterday, we learned about Ernest Shackleton and the voyage of the Endurance from 1914 to 1916. 634 days, 27 people trying to cross Antarctica. That was the goal, and then suddenly the goal was to get out alive. And what that journey was like, and what leadership lessons we learn from that. Leader never loses sight of the goal, but focuses the team on short-term objectives rather than long-term objectives. That they lead by personal example, so we see that that same sense there, but that they're very conscious of symbols. Tomorrow we'll talk about symbols, and I don't mean these. So we'll talk a little bit about what the symbolic role of leadership is. He was optimistic, but he had a firm grip on reality. He believed in taking care physically and psychologically of all the people on his team. So he spent a great deal of energy, more so, less on himself, and much more so on them. He exercised the concept of first team. That is, that his team were the crew, not a couple of people set aside, but he really treated the crew as the first team, the most important team. And if you're part of a complex organization, spending time and sorting out who's really your first team, the people you together are the ones that are trying to move the organization forward. Who are those people? He minimized status. That was his role. He mastered conflict, and he let conflict occur in his organization. He didn't try to silence it. He felt that was important. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. He celebrated. He was lighthearted, even in the absolute face of despair. He was able to celebrate with his colleagues on the boat. He took big risks, calculated, but big, and wasn't afraid to do them. And the last, I think, leadership principle was that he never gave up. He always knew, no matter what, there was another move. There was one other move in the game. And so he never allowed himself to give up. All right, today we're going to focus, and tomorrow really, on trying to give you some tools things that you might be able to work with in your organization. And I'd like you to think about that, because everybody here is involved in some way with an organization, whether it is a university like me, or your school that you may work in, or your church, or a volunteer organization, or your corporation. Whatever facet you're in, you are involved in an organization, and there is likely a leader, and in many instances, you are the leader. And so we're going to talk a little bit about what you do in a situation where the tools that you've used don't work anymore, which is kind of where most of us are. It's new territory. Okay? It's new territory. And there's a book that I'll commend to you. It's not a recent book. This is Ron Heifetz, and the book is called Leadership Without Easy Answers. It is a 1994 book. Ron is at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. He is a trained psychologist and classical musician. His father was Yasha Heifetz. And so he spent a good deal of time looking at organizations that went through adaptive change and came out on the other side a different organization. And he takes a case study after case study and after case study, and then he begins to formulate a theory about how you change an organization. So many of us are likely involved right now in organizations that have to go through adaptive change. And so what I'll give you is a framework today to think about how you might operate as a leader. And we'll come back to why it doesn't really matter if you have a title or not in your organization, that you'll likely be able to operate as a leader in terms of effecting change. Okay, so the first question I have is, what does it mean? What is change? What is change? How do you know when your organization has changed? A lot of people want to change. How do you know when you're there? What's an example that maybe you've been in where an organization has changed?
Just the turnover of people can make a change.
Okay, so new ideas come in? Yep, okay. So the election of the church council, there's change, right? New voices at the table, although sometimes you feel like it's this, didn't we have this conversation, you know, two cycles ago? But that sense of new people bring new ideas. Anybody else been through?
Sometimes imminent failure forces change.
All right, so something happens to the organization, that is, that what it's attempting to do no longer functions. And so it has to do things in a different way?
It becomes a catalyst to look at different ways to approach it.
Okay, all right. So failure in your operation, sometimes external pressure. You know, you suddenly have Wall Street dropping 50, 60, 70%. Something's got to change. We aren't going to be able to keep that going anymore. So those, are there different kinds of changes?
Yes.
Can you?
Well, I was thinking one might be, I'll say, local change, something about the organization itself, a change in leadership, a new CEO or something of that sort. Another type would be external, the stock market, for example, or something beyond the control of the organization that may, in fact, have an impact.
All right, so one kind of change is one that you feel like you have some control over.
Right.
The other one is done to you, and you have to respond to it. Okay? Any other kinds of changes?
Yep. Oh, from an internal standpoint, there could be processes or policies that need to be adjusted or tweaked to so that product or whatever it is that you're providing gets to the end.
So it's a technical change that has to be done.
A technical change or a change of the way that you're doing something.
Okay.
I think a change in a positive, negative, and a neutral, and it does nothing but change for change's sake.
All right, so the people in the organization sense that the change is a good change or a bad change, no change, and sometimes people will change just because they want to change things that might not necessarily add additional benefit. And the members of an organization can sniff that out all pretty quickly. Okay, somebody in the back, yes.
Sometimes the initiation of something has a startup project, and when that's done, you almost need a new vision to continue.
That often happens with entrepreneurs, right? The entrepreneur starts the operation, and it gets to the point where they've got to get out of the way in order for the organization to get into the next level. So sometimes that change out will occur, and different skills and skill sets are needed. All right, let me give you two terms to work with today, so we'll come back to these a few times. The first one we just mentioned, which is technical change. In a technical change, the organization already has the tools. They already know what needs to be done. There's nothing new that needs to be learned. They just need to apply what they already know. So your church might be losing people in the congregation. And so you open up your toolbox and you say, well, you know, maybe we've got in your, you know, you're pretty happy with everything that's going on. It's you know, we stopped doing this particular mailing, or we were advertising in the paper, or we haven't really had a good greeter program, and we need to. So we have this. We have all these things in our toolbox. We know what they are. We'll make these adjustments, and then things start to turn around. Technical change. Okay, adaptive change is far more difficult to achieve, and the adaptive change really involves a change in beliefs or values. Or adaptive change exists when there's a conflict in beliefs and values. So I work at a residential, primarily undergraduate university. And the organization, in order to gain more money at first, and then over time, has added graduate programs. And they've grown to where the graduate programs are a third of the institution. And they're continuing to grow and grow and grow. And so now we have a conflict in the organization between the beliefs and values and who many of the faculty think they are and what the institution is. And so the organization has to work its way through this conflict to figure out how it's going to accommodate throughout the organization for everyone an understanding of how all these pieces fit together. Or your church is, or your school is having an increasing influx of Latino-Latina students whose primary language is Spanish. And you have a belief about how to educate, and you have students coming to you who are operating in a different mode, and so you have to figure out, how do we change? How are we going to adapt? Or in some organizations, the beliefs and values that you hold aren't going to be able to be sustained because the external pressure that's coming on your organization is going to demand that you operate with a new belief or value structure in order to survive. And so adaptive change then really involves changing people's beliefs, which is very hard to do. And the leader can't do it.
Or a cultural change?
A cultural change. I would venture to guess that the cultural changes are nearly impossible to do. A lot of the literature that you read will say that, you know, as a leader, if you're coming into an organization, you haven't been part of that organization, you better keep your eyes open for a year and watch everything that's going on, because culture is largely invisible to the people who are in the organization. Mm-hmm. But coming in from the outside, you can see all these things that don't make sense, but you don't know why. And so you have to discern the culture. You really can't change it. You just have to discern it and then figure out, all right, how does the culture, you know, what structure is there to work within? How could, as a leader, I leverage the culture in order to promote the adaptive change? So I wouldn't advise anybody to try to work on changing the culture. I think the beliefs could, over time, people could choose to bring a new culture to the organization. Okay, let's just I'll go ahead and push a little further.
All right, so this this matter of change has a lot to do with organizational equilibrium. There's a way your organization does things. It's a rhythm that continues year after year. People do come and go, but the organization sort of functions in a different, in a certain way. And one of the things that a leader can do is to create disequilibrium. And this is, if you want to read on that, in this area, this is systems theory, right? Organizational systems theory. And so one of the leader's primary tasks is to determine what kind of disequilibrium to cause in the organization. When a leader stimulates a disequilibrium, then the organization, which you can think about really as a living organism, not single individuals, but really as a living organism, the organization will do anything in its power to restore equilibrium as quickly as possible. So you need to think very carefully about what it is you're trying to introduce, because if you're going to introduce something and it changes the way people operate, you've now introduced disequilibrium. And organizations have very very interesting tactics for dealing with disequilibrium. The first is that I call it watching the gladiators fight. That's the first kind of response to a change in equilibrium. And you do see this at a university in particular, because if there's a change that's introduced, then the junior faculty just sit back and they let the senior faculty duke it out. All right, so people get on the sidelines and they take the people that have will be affected the most by whatever the change is, they just let them fight and they see who wins. So gladiator fighting is very often what happens. First is that, you know, it diverts attention, because the attention goes on the people fighting with whoever introduced the change. You don't make any change, you just fight about the change. But it is a tactic that organizations use, it is that the organism uses in order to avoid the adaptive change. So that's the first one. So it diverts attention. The second is that people don't feel like they have any responsibility. You know, if those folks are going to fight with the leader about what the issue is, and we don't have any responsibility, you know, we have no horse in that race. We're just going to let them. So it means there's no engagement. So there'll be no change. So if you introduce a change in your organization, and suddenly, you know, the union starts to have a big fight with you about it, then recognize, check it off. You're done. Okay, not going to happen. You have to go back and try another strategy. That's not going to get you anywhere. Or people divert attention and say, yeah, but what about this? And off they go, and everybody runs off to whatever it is that they put out there. And again, you won't make a change when that happens. Yeah, one more.
Can this equilibrium be a tool to create chaos and then just come in and do, the leader can come in and make changes that he or she wants to make? Well, I mean, now we're talking about effective leadership, I'm not saying that's the best.
It can be. You know, if you have an economic meltdown and there's tremendous disequilibrium in the system, then you go as fast as you can on as many fronts as possible, and you institute as many changes as you can, because that thing's going to snap back. And if you've introduced enough of those changes, then something's going to move. So we're in the middle of an experiment right now. Hard to say where that's going to go, but that's what happened in that case. Disequilibrium, rush in fast, introduce many sweeping changes, step out, and then let the organization adapt. So that's some of what we're in the middle of now. The second one is, this one happens all the time, and that is standard operating procedure. You introduce a change and the organization snaps right into its standard way of working and dealing with whatever has been introduced, and pretty soon you're keeping the same old routines. You know, well, we'll have a meeting of the faculty senate, and then there'll be a committee, and then so everything just kind of processes and churns through the same old animal and comes out looking just like the sausage does every time. So there isn't really any adaptive change that happens in those kinds of models. The third one is one we see all the time, which is scapegoat. That is, kill the leader. All right, get rid of the leader, because the leader has introduced something that potentially could change us.
and it disrupted the equilibrium. In order to get the equilibrium back, get the leader out.
Could it also be where you purposefully bring in the bulldog to do the hard, be the bad cop, and they come in for a period of time to do the dirty work, and then they leave, like, to do strategic planning?
Absolutely. The corporations will often work this way. You know, the deal's been cut before the chief executive officer ever shows up. Person understands, 24 months. They're going to come in, disrupt, change, introduce something new, you know, eject. New person comes in, hi, we're a big family. And it works. Because they've introduced the change, and it's been in there long enough, they made sure through their work that it's able to stay. Organizations that are going through a real adaptive change have a prolonged period, often, of distress. Prolonged period of distress. And when that occurs, it's easy for people to take their eye off the ball. It's easy even for the leader to take his or her eye off the ball. So in those situations where your organization is under stress for 1, 2, 3 years, which for most of us is right now, we could begin to misdiagnose what's happening, or it's just too much, and so then you just let it, you just back away and let it go right back to equilibrium. So, you know, my challenge to all of you that are, and many of you I know are engaged in adaptive change right now, don't give up, even though it just seems too distressing for too long, because your job is to help shepherd the organization to the other side. And if you let up, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a couple of minutes, but if you let up, then you've actually failed as the leader, because the organization will not adapt. It will snap back. And if you don't think it, you know, if you look for little signs like maybe it's changing, until it's been fundamental, until there's been a fundamental adaptation, it will go back to what it was. It will not change. So it's important that you have to ride those things out from the beginning to the end. Okay. So,
I was just going to say, sir, this really parallels family systems theory involving the parish and all that. Instead of equilibrium, it's homeostasis. Instead of killing the leader, it's identified patient, which is often the pastor, they're the bad guy. And so it's just fascinating to hear that there's two things emerging there, and how do you deal with that, and that whole sense of hanging in there, because that's the hard part. And what Friedman would say, started it all, would say, you know, pastors really got to be self-differentiated and be able to, you know, wade through all that pressure.
And not get pulled in.
Right, not get hooked.
Yeah, not get pulled in. All right, so I'm going to just talk about them. What's the leader's role in making change? So if this is really something we want to do or you want to do in your organization, what's your role? How do you do it? Where do you start? What's the most important thing as a leader you have to do?
Stay calm.
Stay calm?
Create a vision.
Creative
inspire,
vision. Listen.
Initiate actions.
Okay.
Inspire.
Have
a team.
Have a team. Get the team together.
Before you can do any of that, you have to establish the trust level to build for people to follow.
Okay. Earn trust.
Build trust.
Build your social capital. Okay. Anybody else? How are you going to do it? What's the first thing you need to do? Build your capital, right? So
money in the bank.
Well, let me pose this. The most important thing you have to do as the leader is identify the problem. Because often we confuse the symptom with the problem. And we think that something that we see is happening in our organization is the thing that needs to change, rather than kind of going deeper. Anybody want to take that on and provide an example of what that might be, where the symptom sometimes presents and you've misdiagnosed and the problem still is underneath it? Anyone want to take that one on?
Let's talk about the first bailout. you jump on something that you think is such a way and you want to get something through quick, but you're not getting the right thing.
All right, so we just throw a bunch of money at a bank or at a car manufacturer. You could see that Treasury was learning as it went. So by the time it got to GM, it understood the problem more effectively. And that's going to be a perfect example of what we're going to talk about today, what played out there. Okay, so I think that trying to figure out what the problem is where you need to spend your time. Diagnosing that problem and not jumping too quickly to the conclusion that this is the issue. Let's see if I... Yes?
Yeah, instead of an asset-based model, you look at what your positive, which assets you have first before you look at your problems, wouldn't you?
I don't know. I think that your asset base when you're dealing with the monetary, that's a presentation of what's occurring. There's something that's occurring underneath the assets and liabilities that is causing the issue to present itself. I mean, you need to know what your assets are. You need to know who you have on your team. You need to know the strengths and weaknesses of the organization. But you won't be able to make any progress until you understand. Put it this way. You need to know how to frame the problem for your organization, because your organization is the one that has to change. So spending time diagnosing the problem and then trying to frame it is the most important thing that you would need to do. Maybe we'll come back to that as we go through this and you run it through your model. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Is it important to involve the organization in identifying the problem? Is there some ownership bit that through the process that there's an organic understanding that's built?
Yeah, I would agree. Yes.
Jumping ahead?
You are jumping ahead, but the issue is if you don't know what the problem is, then you don't know what you need to ask the organization to take on.
Okay, so you still have to do your own work with maybe some experts. You bring in some folks. So obviously you need some advisors, some data,
Right, but at some point you have to decide, because there are a myriad ways you could approach it with your organization. But ultimately, at the end of the day, you're going to say, this is the problem, and here's the question I'd like you to work on. So getting that clear, understanding that piece is the most important thing you need to do.
Is that a piece of the intelligence that a leader brings to an organization?
Yes. Yeah. And the listening.
Identify the problem.
Yeah. Not the solution, by the way. The leader never has the solution. Just the problem.
Could it be more complex? In other words, it's a problem, but it may be maybe multiple problems. And you have to determine whether, in fact, it's a single problem or a group of interrelated problems.
But a large organization, complex, even a small one, can work on really one thing. I think you have to frame it so that it becomes a very clear question that might be very complicated when you unpack it, but you've got everybody focused on one thing. Yes, go ahead.
It's at this point, isn't it, that most organizations hire their consultants.
Who doesn't know the organization.
To come in to do the thing. And like you said, the experts. You've got somebody from outside. You paid them money to because they're supposed to be the experts.
Yep. The experts are in your organization, folks.
Yeah, yeah.
The experts are in your organization, and people that jump right to consultants to solve the problems are only going to have more problems because the people don't know the organization and you have not empowered the people to solve the problem. Mm-hmm. There's no adaptation that occurs. Mm-hmm. Now, consultants can help you alongside, yeah, talk in your ear, say, yeah, here's expertise and information that you may need, but if you aren't in the driver's seat in framing the question, and the people in your organization aren't solving the problem, the organization will not change.
And don't those people end up resenting the consultants, really?
Yes.
For the very reason that they're not part of it? Yeah.
Because scapegoat. Yeah. That consultant came in, doesn't know us, okay? And so will they change? No.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, they won't change.
You'll hire another study next year.
So let me just give you a little example. And since we're up in this part of the country, I was thinking about this. And back 25 years ago, in the town of Ruston, Washington, there was a gigantic copper smelting plant.
ASARCO.
And ASARCO was basically the employer for that part of the country. And there was a new czar, one of the first czars in the federal government, who was William Ruckelshaus, who was the head of the EPA. And there was a conflict in values that was occurring because Asarco was putting arsenic into the air. And it was causing cancer, purportedly, other kinds of environmental illnesses that were born of that. And so there was a conflict in values between jobs in Ruston, Washington, and the health of the people who lived in that area. And so Ruckelshaus said, you got to figure out which is more important to you. And you need to tell me. And then we'll decide as the EPA how we're going to respond. And so he convened a series of public hearings at which he said nothing and had people gather in groups to sort out which was more important, jobs or health. And they came up with a solution that nobody anticipated and that they didn't anticipate, which was we have to bring other industries into Ruston, Washington. It was one of the first examples. We're certainly experiencing that in Northwest Indiana. Okay, now, we need to bring in more industries and we need to diversify because if this plant goes out of business, we are going to all lose our jobs and our community is going to collapse. And so they began a wide process of diversification. They were well on the way to bringing in new industry so that when the plant actually closed, which was 3 or 4 years later, they adjusted. It's a thriving community. But that was an example of a person saying, you have conflicting values here. I can't solve this for you. But the issue is, which is more important to you? Jobs or health? And when you answer that, then we will respond. So what he did in framing that question, you know, they tried to get him thrown out of the government. They tried everything. They said, that's not the issue. The issue is this. There were a variety of those things. The plant decided they were going to have, you know, they were going to take him on. They were going to sue him. So, you know, they had the gladiators fighting. They used every possible avoidance tactic. But he said, no, I'm not budging. And you let me know, and then we'll deal with it. So what he did by doing this was to create for this community what is known as a holding environment. A holding environment. So once you've framed a problem as a leader, then the next thing you need to do is to figure out how do you construct a holding environment for the organization to engage in the adaptive work. And that's the second most important thing you have to do as a leader, is figure out how do you construct it so that the people in the organization solve the problem. Use an example at our university, and this is not a jobs health issue, but we had an organization that had a pretty good strategic plan. They did one every 5 years. They knew how to do a strategic plan. They were very well organized, and I sensed coming in the organization needed to go through adaptive change. So I said, I'm just going to ask you one question this year, and that is, what is your most desired future? I didn't ask them for a strategic plan. The strategic plan was going away. Folks were coming in my office saying, the strategic plan ends on May 31st. What are we going to do? We need to get a strategic plan in place. I said, no, I just want to know what your most desired future for the institution is. That's all. And they thought, well, they kind of got their arms around that. And then we created a process where people could get together. And we didn't let them out, really, of the process until they had articulated their most desired future. And so then they had it. They actually knew what it was. It wasn't a radical change from where they were, but they had never talked about what the vision of the organization would be. Of course, the day I started, they came and said, Mark, what's your vision for the university? And I said, I don't know. What's your vision? Which, you know, you take a lot of flack for that. But I said, I can't tell you what the vision is. But if we get together and we work on the most desired future and you work on it together, we come out the other side, we'll have it. And then I'll sell it. So that's a way to think about in your organization. Are there ways that you can construct that? Can you bring your community together? Can you frame a question? And can you do it in such a way that people feel compelled to answer it? That they have ownership of it and are compelled to answer it? So that's the second principle. Now, you can't really have a holding environment unless you have authority. For folks that weren't here, what's authority?
Influence.
Folks that weren't here, what's that?
Influence.
Influence? Okay. What's authority?
Something that's given to you by others.
All right, something that is given to you.
The gavel.
What's that?
The gavel.
The gavel, okay. All right, so two words. It's given to you, it's conferred, which means that who gives it to you?
Community. Agency.
The people in your organization. They give it to you. Authority. Okay.
We talked about formal and informal.
Okay.
The formal by virtue of position in the organization or name, and informal by virtue of the fact that you have social capital or trust and all of those other things.
All right, so formal authority accrues to you because you have a position. You're the president. You're the manager, you're the director, you're the principal. So now you have authority. But the authority is bounded by your job description. And no more. And can any of you get anything done with your job description? No. All right, it won't allow you to get any adaptive change done, but it does give you the boundaries that the organization has given you formally and attached a position to it. Informal authority is where the power is. All right, so authority is conferred power to perform a service. It is bestowed entirely by the followers in your organization. So it is conferred power to perform a service. It's conferred by the members in the organization who aren't the leaders. It's the gavel. And you are being asked to execute or perform something. So, if in your analysis of authority, you believe that you have sufficient conferred power, the people in your organization will actually want you to hold them and place them there. They'll be glad you did because you've empowered them. So you want to gauge authority. Okay, here's the one where we get tripped up. We're the leader, and we know what needs to be done, and we know what's best for the organization. We even know what it looks like on the other side. And the organization ain't ready. And that's a matter of the issue of ripeness. Is the issue that you want to work on in your organization ripe? And you'll know pretty quickly, because the moment you try to do this, it'll fall apart. The people in your organization are not ready yet. And you may even think and know that if you don't attend to this as a church or as a school or as a voluntary group, if you don't attend to it, the organization's not going to come out on the other side. It's not going to survive. You may even know that. But the people in your organization don't. So how do you get them there?
Trick them.
I haven't discussed manipulation yet. It's Friday, I believe.
That's Saturday. Friday's Christian.
Disrupt the equilibrium.
All right.
Take any equilibrium out so that they're forced to begin looking at it or wrestling with what's going on.
Okay, so you could. Say, for example, some people will do this. We're going to have an exercise in zero-based budgeting. That's disequilibrium, right? That is, everybody's budget next year is zero, and then you have to tell me what you need.
Justify what you want.
In order of importance.
It sounds like American households.
Yeah. Right. So that some folks will use the budget as a way of creating that disequilibrium or I can remember being a provost, I said to the faculty, all rules for a governing tenure and promotion will sunset 2 years from now. And so in 2 years, you have got to develop a set of tenure and promotion criteria that are mutually agreeable. I left, by the way.
How did that go?
They were ready. The issue was right.
Yeah. And you were, well, I think here's where some of our Lutheran values about doing two things at once, holding them in tension, and this would be my thinking, something that engenders greater trust, but also come on and take that, you are going to take this next step. So somehow doing those two movements simultaneously.
How will you build that trust? How can you get there?
Speaking experientially, both thinking of others in leadership, but my own practice, partly being accessible, the listening, but also implementing some small ideas where people get that if they're on to something about change, it's not just going to be thrown away because it was their idea rather than my idea. So,
yeah, some people will use task forces, mm-hmm. pilot projects, mm-hmm. you know, just something that will show people another model.
Forums.
Go ahead, talk about that.
Well, listening forums, you know, you have a goal in mind, but you've got to bring everybody along. So you design a process of listening. You ask questions, you listen, you get input, you're shooting for kind of a, to get people to buy in.
Okay, yep.
I'm wondering about what happens when you're a leader and you know that the organization needs to change, but they're not ripe yet. Then is there a way of adding nitrogen? I mean, is there a way of, you know, like quickening that ripening process? Because I know, like with alcoholics, yeah, they need to stop drinking, and you know what? They're not going to stop drinking until they're done drinking. And they might need to stop for a long time, and it will never happen until they're done. So I just wonder about churches. You know, there are a lot of churches, like they need to change, they need to change. And at what point are they ready to change? There's the well that I talked about today or yesterday in Charlotte, North Carolina. There was a dying elderly congregation, and they were like in hospice care for churches, right? And they saw the well, and they saw this new life, and they said, we want to join you, and we want to come together as one church, and we're going to give up our vote and our money for 3 years to you.
But somebody took
ready.
Them there.
Yeah.
Somebody took them there, and they could see something.
Yeah.
So I would say, you know, for a leader, if you don't think the issue is right, one of the things that you need to do is you need to educate your people.
It's part of persuasion we talked about.
Right. That's the matter of being persuasive and trying to influence people to the point where they get and they take ownership of it. So you want to think carefully about the flow of information. Giving people the information, enough information to begin with, that they begin to get their arms around the same problem you're dealing with. And that's scary, because if you give them the information and you don't have sufficient informal authority, then you've actually given away what little power you have. But what may occur is that you gain their trust and you're given more, which is some of the issue there. So having trust in your organization and the people in your organization that they can grasp what it is that you're facing, and that they can actually work on solutions. To say, we have a problem. So this year I said to our folks, we have a problem. There's a $15 million gap between what it is that we want to spend next year and the money we think we're going to have come in. How are we going to deal with that? Because I have no idea. And we dealt with it. But the ideas came throughout the organization, and there were a lot of ideas I could have never sat in my office and come up with. But people were, they had ownership of the problem, and they had ownership of the priorities. So I think information flow is very important. So just be aware of this matter of ripeness. You've got to gauge the ripeness on that issue that you want to take on. And again, the signs will be there if you're paying close attention to how the people in your organization are responding. People that whose counsel you trust, and your dissidents, you know, really looking at all of them. Your dissidents are very important.
Is that information, or is there other?
Well, it's the flow of information. If you gave, it's in some instances, if you gave your organization all the information that you'd have, you'll paralyze them. So this is the ethical dimension. You're a doctor, and you know and have discovered through testing that the patient that you're counseling is likely terminal. So if you walked in and said, you know, Mr. Jones, you're going to be dead in 3 months with the family members present, what'll happen? Okay. You've disrupted, but haven't given a path. There's no holding environment for, all right. So the doctor in that case has to control the flow of information. If you're going to help get the family and the person to adapt to the change in the circumstances so that they can enjoy that time together, then as a doctor, you need to construct very carefully what the holding environment is. And what you're asking people to do is you give them information and you're helping them to work their way through. Those of you in the pastoral role probably encounter that as well. Think about the information. Now the dilemma for you, if you're like me, is if I have something, I don't want to keep it from somebody. I want to give them the information, and that to hold it back seems immoral. But if you think about the fact that you will give them all the information, when they're ready to receive it and process it, you can help an organization through the change that they need to get to, because they can construct then the change once they understand everything. All those things make sense? So as a leader, you've created a holding environment. The group's working on jobs versus health. What do you do while all this is going on?
Play golf.
Call Mark.
Play golf? Call Mom. Mom?
What do you do?
Walk around.
You walk around? So explain that.
Management by walking around. You try to see what people are thinking, where they're going. You kind of listen, and if...
Take the pulse.
You hear somebody that's connecting or... You be a connector where you can connect various ideas that you hear and say, you know, you want to talk to so-and-so.
But the group turns to you, what's your first name?
Skip.
They turn to you and say, Skip, but what do you think?
Well, you know, this is your problem. I don't know. I'm pastor. I'll try to do whatever you want. But, you know, I'm here to preach the gospel, and the gospel doesn't have any.
It's not in your job description?
Yeah, it's not. You know, I want to know what you want to do. And right now, the question is yours.
So how do you not get a response that what you've just done is laissez-faire, man? Laissez-faire.
I don't get that. And that's, Dave, isn't that right?
Right? So that sense of, you know, I am helpless to deal with this situation. All right, so you want to think about what that interaction is. Lenore, let's say, you know, what do you think, Lenore? We're working on this problem, and I know we've got this, this, and this. Which way should we go? What do you say?
Are you asking me about this situation?
Well, no problem.
Anything.
Your situation.
You're the consultant.
Oh, you're the leader. You're not the consultant.
I'm the leader? I don't know.
Well, I think the earlier, you know, your first response would be something that might work well. That is, you know, I heard over here, and I thought that was an interesting idea. So you're engaged. It isn't that you're not engaged. It isn't that you're not thinking about how to deal with the problem, but it's not solely yours to solve. Because once you tell them, that's okay. You know, that's what he wants. That's what he wants. And so off you go. And guess what? If it doesn't work, it's you. So walking around is a pretty good strategy. Listening, passing and sharing information with different groups might be working. Folks will say that the leader's job in this period largely is to stay on the balcony, because the groups that are working on this want you in the middle. They want to pull you right in. So you have this delicate line to walk between ensuring that people understand that you care deeply about what the result's going to be, but you may not have the knowledge to come up with the answer.
That's really hard to do, though. In the organization that I'm in, the leader, it does not matter what he likes this, he does this, he preaches this, but no matter what we come up with, it doesn't go. It goes nowhere. So you spin tires in the mud forever. I've been spinning tires for 2 years, and it goes nowhere. So what?
Your leader already has the solution, so you're being manipulated.
But he
didn't accept it.
Yeah.
He didn't trust that what you were going to put forward was the answer. We had this conversation yesterday, you know. It might not be what you do or the way you do it, but you've given the question to the group, and you have to take what comes back, or you've just destroyed the trust.
Don't you think, too, though, that when the gladiators start battling, or if you have a small, like I work in a school, and we all have a certain number of parents who are special needs or whatever you want to call them, and the parents.
Struck a chord.
It could be, you know, employees in an organization. You know, in ours it's the parents. And isn't there some dynamic whereby you bring those that are the most fired up about it in close to the leader, so that you're the ear, you take all, so that they aren't out in the community cranking out the gossip mill, and you know, I'm sure the pastors here know something about
helicopter parents do.
Managing those challenging constituents.
Well, they are part of the constituency. They have to be part of the solution. Otherwise, things won't change. So you've got to, you know, whether you're talking about keeping the team of rivals and having them, you know, close to you and having your dissidents right by your side, which is a team strategy, or in this, trying to work on a solution and making sure that the dissidents, people that you might not agree with, are absolutely at the table and that they are wrestling with your colleagues in the solution, because what's going on with those parents is the conflict in beliefs. So you can't get to the other side until you put those beliefs in a holding environment and you have them work on a question until they can get on the other side of it. You can't, it won't change.
Mark, I have a question about information at this point at the balcony. So if you're watching and they're kind of going off in a direction that if they had some information, maybe they'd know that wouldn't work, do you give them that information or just let them go?
You want to give them information, not to prejudice their outcome, but to say, you know, here's some more information you may want to have. And share that with them, and you know, I just think it might inform your conversation. Yeah, I think that's helpful.
I'm always trying to reinterpret in terms of faith, and it seems to me that the first question is not where you want to be in 5 years, the organization 5 years is where do you see God wanting us to be in 5 years. It's one. Second, when people ask me what do you think we should do, my response is, what do you think God is calling us to do? And we really try, and not very well sometimes, to help folks understand that discernment is within the faith community. It's not based on, you know, the hair pastor or whatever. And because it goes right to our call process, which is that the community calls in the same way with the discernment. So it's the same stuff you're saying. Instead of saying the right time, I say Kairos moment, God's time for something to happen. So I'm just trying to, you know,
well,
from my standpoint.
But you're also dealing with the issue of beliefs, so you're incorporating beliefs into the conversation, and that's the conflict becomes, this is what God's calling us to do, here are the resources we have, and how are we going to, among other questions, how are we going to get there in terms of addressing whatever the problem might be. So I think that just gets right to the heart of it.
I think related to that is the fact that each person involved in this whole process has belief issues, but also emotional needs
that can't help but enter into whatever is the process is. And it's not that, that a leader can or should be become the, you know, the caretaker of those emotional needs, but I think that, that recognizing that they're there and acknowledging that and the role they play can be a really important part too of just building that kind of trust.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a part of what I think you can do in the leadership role when you're dealing with interpersonal and personality. You know, things are much more complicated there. Is to have the group really work through how will we treat and operate with one another, and let's hold each other accountable to that way of working together. Setting that up at the very beginning, and you know, making that part of the process. These are the ground rules governing how we're going to work, especially if there's a aberrant behavior that can destroy the ability of a group to get to a, you know, to get to the other side of something. So,
right. But by acknowledging that, you also can help the people beyond that to the point at which they're actually dealing with the information and problems. I don't know.
No, I agree. I would agree. But sometimes those emotional interactions are just a diverting tactic.
Absolutely.
Right. We don't get along. That, you know, it just reframes it, and you got to keep bringing them back to the question. So the leader's role then isn't to have the answer. And whenever you feel like you have the answer, you got to back away. Especially if it's a technical problem. That is, if we just change this in the marketing department, it'll solve everything. And you know that after you've analyzed it, then let that happen. That's a different thing. But if what you're asking your organization to do is to change in a fundamental way, you've got to construct it in a way where you're not giving them the answer. And whatever answer you get, you got to go with. You got to be able to live with that and move it ahead, because the ownership of that will be and can be transformational for those employees or for the people on your team. And they can hold each other accountable. And I'll give you one other thing, and this is getting back to that consultant, the issue of the consultant. I'm a firm believer that the knowledge that you always need is in the room. And you just need to trust it. It just never fails that the knowledge is in the room, especially if you have a diverse organization. So as a leader, you know, if you can encourage and build a diverse organization in terms of worldview, cultural background, all of that, it will mean a healthy organization. I think we got tripped up a little bit in how we approach diversity, and more are coming to understand that having all those different ways of thinking around the table actually gives you a very rich solution. Whereas having a lot of people who are the same tackle a problem, you'll have some huge blind spots. So discouraging that groupthink and allowing really those dissident voices to come forward. I'll keep reinforcing that. I did that yesterday as well. Lift up dissident voices. Hold them close to you. Give them voice. Allow them to speak. Mm-hmm. And it will help you. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not there to take you on. They're actually there to teach you something. Mm-hmm. You may not agree with them, but what they will force you to do is to think.
I think that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
That's my usual response. Well, okay, let's go.
Right towards you, too.
I won't have time this week to talk about some of those team principles, but that issue of conflict is certainly something that those of us who come, you know, and are working in church organizations, there's another thing operating there that sometimes gets misunderstood, that disagreement is healthy. And as a leader, you can encourage that. It's healthy for your organization for that to be expressed openly, where people aren't going out there and doing it, you know, doing it, getting it on the table and encouraging that is very, very helpful.
If there's a deadlock in the process of coming up with the solution, what then is the leader's role?
Holding environment.
You can't give up. That's the thing. When it's prolonged distress, you just have to hold it there. Well, we can't. And you have to figure out, if you've constructed a good holding environment, then you've got leverage. It's not the boycott of North Korea. You know, you got to come up with a, you got to come up with something that's going to give you leverage, so that and you've got to think through that whole part through very carefully, so you can keep them there. We aren't going to be able to do this until we figured this out. And they so want to do this that provides great motivation to.
So in your framing this year, when they asked you about the strategic plan, what was this? While they came up with what they really wanted to do.
I had it easy. I had it easy. They wanted to do it. They were ripe. The issue was ripe. And they ran. They took it and ran with it. So, you know, this year, I'm in a very healthy organization. So, you know, those of you that are in more challenging organizations, it's a matter of trying to discern what it is that is on the other side of that, and being able to show them, you know, if we can get through this, then we can get here. Mm-hmm. But taking the time to do this will yield this, and by sharing information, you know, giving them the information that you think they need to have to get that done, you're helping them. You're helping to persuade them, and then your ability to move ahead. You know, you use that power of persuasion to change people's thinking. Howard Gardner, psychologist, has a number of books that talk about the purpose of the leader's, main purpose of the leader is to tell a new story. And by telling a new story, then it begins to change the way people are thinking about. At Valpo, we're a pan-Lutheran organization. We have ELCA and LCMS, students, faculty, theology. We have all of that there. It's a rich environment. As you might imagine, sometimes we get at odds with each other. But that's 38% of us. The majority of people are not Lutheran. So we had to figure out how do you frame that? What is the story you want to tell about that place that makes people who aren't Lutheran feel like they're welcome? So we've hit upon this phrase that we're a Lutheran university, but constituted of people, by people of many beliefs. We're Lutheran, but we're constituted by people from many beliefs. And that was language that I think has resonated well with our community. And so then we spend our energy on, then what is Lutheran in a university setting? And it's a very rich conversation when you put Lutheran students in a conversation with our Hindu students and our Islamic students. They're all together and pursuing together, what does that mean? It's a pretty rich environment. But that's telling a new story. The story prior to that was, we're a Lutheran university and we show hospitality.
Getting back to when you get into loggerheads or you get stuck, one of the processes we've used for the last couple of years is consensus, and where we talk about an issue, then we do kind of a thumb poll around the room of, yes, it's a go, I need more information is a sideways thumb, or a block is down. And you talk about it first, you lay the ground rules. If you're blocking, it's a serious thing. You really mean, I can't live with this. You don't use that lightly. And then if you get then we just keep talking, and we do in a small groups. And you come back and you just keep working on all the questions until you move those thumbs and you move enough thumbs up. And then finally, if there's enough thumbs up and not so many sideways, you say, do we have any blockers? If you don't have any blockers and you got enough of these, then you can move forward. And it's one process we've used, and I'm sure there's many others.
So it's a way for you to gauge where people are on issues. The question you're going to ask yourself as a leader is, are we having this conversation about something technical or adaptive? You know, are we dealing with something that is, you know, and to try to, in your spending your leadership time with the organization on those things that are the adaptive changes that are needed.
This is a small, intimate organization. So it's, you know, we can have those kinds of sessions over maybe 4 board meetings and make a decision. So I'm not talking about your kind of setting.
Any other comments or perspective before we close up here? Tomorrow, we're going to talk a little bit about how you look at a problem. So there won't be any more leadership theory this week. Tomorrow is when you have a problem, how could you make sure that you don't have any blind spots? So I'll try to give you a framework for how to analyze it. And out of that, I think it might help you identify the lens that you typically use to look at a problem. And hopefully I'll be able to give you three other lenses so that you can think about things and then develop your processes on the basis of a more thorough understanding of the problem. So that's what we're going to focus on, a little bit of a tool for that. Blessings on your evening. Thank you for being here.